Okay, kia ora. Good morning, everyone. For our third sign language. So this session is upgrading SQL Server. So I'm David Lyth. I'm a Premier Field Engineer with Microsoft. So my job, I get to tiki-too around talking to people like you about SQL Server, primarily proactively. So I get the luxury of not going into it's all broken, please make it work again, but more around here it is, it's working nicely, what can we do to make it even better? So today, we're talking about upgrading SQL Server. So as Miles highlighted in the previous session, SQL Server 2005 is coming up to a significant milestone in its life cycle. So it's worthwhile talking about upgrading SQL Server, and especially from SQL Server 2005, what can we get, and why should we do it, as opposed to why do you have to do it? So today we'll talk through some of the benefits that come out of the later editions, some of the tools that we have available for you, what are some of the blockers, and then just step through the how of the process, not at a deeply technical level, because it's a 200-level session, but just high-level overview. So benefits. So just stepping through the major areas rather than a whole technical edition-based view of the world. First off is security. So we all know in the back of our minds that security is really important. But just to highlight from an example locally, we know that about 3 years ago there was a company called Weedle, and they launched an online auction site to buy and sell secondhand goods. Sort of similar to another company that we know and love. So they went live with this site, they were quite happy with it, and they made headlines in the paper. Unfortunately, it was for the wrong reason. So the customers got on, they found that there were things that they weren't happy about with the security of the site. So Weedle pulled the site offline, as they should, and started working away to fix those flaws and turn it into a secure website. So they worked away, and this is what their website looks like today. So 2 years after they pulled it offline, they wound up the whole company. So really a salient lesson that if we don't get security right, there can be significant impacts both for us and for our organizations. So back in the 2000-2005 days, SQL didn't really have a lot to offer in terms of detailed security configuration. This was pretty much about it. You could either track failed logons, which didn't give you very much to go on at all, or you could turn on C2 auditing and blow your disks away instantly and not have any really good tools to analyze that data anyway. So we've come a long way since then. So things that you get now in the newer versions of SQL once you upgrade. SQL Audit, big new tool that's available. So this is the ability to configure what you want to audit, how much you want to audit, and tools to analyze that stuff. And it lets you control separation of duties activities. So if you really need to be able to put your hand on your heart and say, yes, we've audited everything, you can set audit up to record away from your normal operations systems. So you can have audit records that your normal admins can't touch. So you're able to mitigate that risk of your auditors coming in and saying, hey, but your admins can edit all those audit records anyway, so it's not really worthwhile. So it's a great new feature that's coming in the later versions of SQL and a great benefit for upgrading. Encryption, another great thing. So we've got two big areas that encryption has come in for. One is data at rest. So this is your transparent data encryption. So being able to encrypt all your data files and know that even if you get an attacker comes onto your machine somehow, grabs your data files, if they're not coming through SQL Server, they can't get access to your plain text data. So real peace of mind stuff there that's really hard to do any other way, and it's not available in the earlier versions of SQL. So the other piece of encryption that we've got now as well is your backups. So you'll be aware that if a bad guy gets hold of your backup file, then they have complete and total access to all of your data. And it doesn't matter how they get hold of that backup file, so it could be from a tape that's been lost out of your offsite storage facility. Could be if you're putting things up on a global file share that people have got read access to easily get hold of old stuff. As long as you've got read access to that backup file, you've got total access to all the data. So backup encryption has come in. So you can encrypt that with a key that you control. So it means that the only way to get the data back out of that backup file is with the key. Obviously, you need to manage all of your key level backup and restores as well, but that's part and parcel of managing your security. So both of those give you a lot more peace of mind that your data is not going to be intercepted outside of your local SQL instance and used for nefarious purposes. So great stuff. Slightly different SLART server core. So one of the core principles of security is that you reduce the surface area available for attack. Means that bad guys have got fewer known vectors to actually get into your system with. So server core serves this principle up. Says, don't put Windows on with all of the things that you don't actually need to make SQL run. You don't need GUI tools. So SQL supports using server core. Obviously, you need to plan this a wee bit more because you need to manage it remotely. You need to manage it potentially with PowerShell. But planning how you manage things is not really a bad thing. It also has the side benefit that because you've got fewer pieces installed on that server core, you've got fewer things to patch. So some of the stats say potentially up to 60% less patching activity needed for server core. So a great way to secure and stabilize the platform that your SQL environments are running on. Managed service accounts. So for those people who get IT auditors coming through, you'll know the pain of service accounts. So service accounts by definition have full and total access to all of your data. That's the way they work. And traditionally, we use domain accounts. They've got a password that's set up at design stage and usually doesn't change very often because it's a non-trivial process to change this. And it's even more painful if you've done what a number of people have done and share the same service account across multiple applications and instances, because then you're into the world of pain of trying to coordinate an outage across lots of your applications to try and get that password changed. And if you've got IT auditors, you'll know that you either suffer the black mark of having that on your audit report, which the business people are quite excited about, or going through setting up this non-trivial process. So managed service accounts are great because when you start using these, no one knows the password, and the password is regularly changed under the covers. There's no need to actually do anything, it just happens. So the caveat that this only applies to standalone SQL Server, can't use it for clusters yet. So hopefully that will change. And if I say group managed service accounts, you can Google that. Separation of duties. So another big thing traditionally in 2005, 2000 environments, you've got a system administrator or administrators, and the only way for it to operate is you put your trust in them, which hopefully you can trust people, but it's been seen regularly in the past that there's a number of people that trust is misplaced. So separation of duties, we've started to move towards this. We've got features like control server, so you can take away sysadmin from your DBAs. And that means you've got people who can manage and maintain your SQL servers without having the access to actually view the data that's inside there. So if they're managing your payroll database, they don't necessarily have access to read the salaries that everyone in your company has. So that's a journey that's started. I don't think it's finished by any stretch of the imagination, but it's a direction that's going there. Row-level security was mentioned in the previous talk, and we talk about it a little bit more on Friday in a session. So this is the idea of being able to write down at the row level, segregate permissions. So the example that we've got on Fridays talks about a hospital, and if you've got medical staff who need access to patient data, they only get to see the patients that they're actually working with directly. They just right at the database level don't have any access to that. So a lot of these features, including row-level security, people have done themselves. So they've written custom code, they've made their application work like this. So one of the big benefits of doing it out of the box with SQL is you don't have to maintain all that custom code. You know that lots of people are using the same feature, so there's lots of people with eyes on the code to say, we've found this defect, because with your custom code, you may not know that there's defects in there because you're the only ones using it. And doing it at the database level rather than the application means there's less opportunity for people to do an attack from the side, come in, use ODBC driver, something like that, and evade your row-level security that you've built into the application. And data masking is another feature we'll talk about more on Friday as well. So this is the ability for things like credit cards to write out of your select statements, just mask out and only show two or three digits of things like a credit card number. So another great feature. Again, you could build it yourself in the application, but you end up with lots of custom code that you're then maintaining and looking after. So that's security. Performance, because everyone likes their SQL server to go faster. So one of the big things that we get in newer versions is compression. So big areas for compression, we've got page and row level for your data. Obviously, compression is a performance feature because you fit your data into fewer pages on disk. You've got fewer IOs to bring it off. And you can fit more data into the same pages in memory. So you can cache more. So you've got fewer requirements to go down and grab the stuff back off disk. So great stuff there. The other area that we've got compression on is your backups. So backups are really IO intensive, and you want them to run in your quiet period where you don't have people trying to use the database for real application work. So without compression, you're putting a lot more write IOs on wherever you're storing that backup. So this helps by scaling down the outage window that you actually need where you've got that high IO going on your databases. It's a great feature. It also saves you some disk space, especially if you're saving 31 copies of your backup. If you've got a terabyte database and you're able to compress it, it starts to mount up, even though the mantra is always disk is cheap, storage cost is declining to zero. Someone still has to pay for it. So that's compression. Now, as a sideline, some of the features that we deliver with an initial set of functionality, which is nice for a look in, sometimes a wee bit limited. And so sometimes it's a wee bit like this nose that was parked outside Te Papa for about 3 months. So it's great to climb in, you can have a look and tweak the things, but it doesn't really fly to start with. So some of our features, we deliver limited functionality to start with, but then we build on that and eventually grow wings and they're able to get ready to take off and fly away. So a perfect example of that is column store. We brought that in with 2012. You could only have non-clustered. They could only be read-only when you put them on the tables. You've had the pain of this, yeah. So we've built on that in 2014, and there's more to come in 2016. So coming in 16, we'll get fully featured, clustered, non-clustered. They'll be able to play nicely with all your other indexes, constraints. And for those of you who were at Miles's session just before, the whole ability to have your OLTP tables and column stores parked on the side of those and be able to mix and match your ETL workloads on top of your OLTP in a much better fashion. So column store is really aimed at your data warehouses. So for people who are still back on 2005 data warehouses and you're using traditional tables to store your data warehouses, and then this gives you really great performance improvements. It also gives you a lot of compression in your tables, so talking sort of potentially 5 times, 10 times compression for your data. So does great things for your performance for your data warehouse. In some cases, you're able to do things you just couldn't do before because of your performance constraints. So really big benefit for getting up to 2012 and beyond. In-memory OLTP, New Zealand, it's a little bit more of an edge case because you do have to make changes to your tables. You have to make sure that you write your stored procs and actually make changes to your application. But for people who have got a requirement for really high throughput OLTP systems, so you've, I think the classic example we use is the BWIN, people who have the betting on the first goal in the football game of Man U versus City. And so that's a really high throughput requirement that they have, and they're really, really happy with that. So if you have a requirement, it's there as a way to extend. You're not stuck with the, it's only SQL Server, it only goes so far and then we have to stop. So it really enhances that performance capability. So the cardinality estimator, this is a sort of little bit of plumbing under the covers, which is all part and parcel of getting to the query plan. So 2014, this whole thing got rewritten to make it faster because the existing code was back from the dawn of time, just after Jurassic Park, I think. So they rewrote a lot of this and did a lot of work to make it more intelligent, especially with the data volumes that we're seeing today. So back when the old version was written, we were talking relatively small databases, and now you're seeing multi-terabyte databases. So this was changed to do that. So that's another great reason to get up. Buffer pool extension is just the ability of you've maxed out memory on your server and you need more cache. You can use SSDs now to make your cache bigger and get even more there. And there's lots of little tweaks that they've put in through all the various releases. So optimize for ad hoc is just one example of this, where you can have a workload, and if you've got lots and lots of singleton queries that never get rerun, you can change that behavior and it makes things better. So lots of little things like that that have come out through the various releases. So that's performance. So functionality, so what do you get? Shiny new toys to work with. And again, this comes back to you could have done it some other way. Now you get out of the box tools that are just there ready for you to use. Always on, the big poster child of 2012, which most people I think will be familiar with. So the whole idea of out of the box being able to have a single tool that does high availability and disaster recovery for you, and gives you the added bonus of being able to do readable secondaries. So again, in terms of people building custom solutions, various people have done things like setting up SQL replication to have a continually readable secondary. So you can throw that away and just use always on, because trying to maintain replication, there's a significant overhead in that and making sure you capture all the changes. Capture data change and temporal. So back in 2005, you didn't have any good mechanism for knowing what had changed in your tables. Again, you'd use things like triggers or some sort of extra column that you needed to add on and keep up to date. So 2008 gave us capture change, capture data change. Great new feature, again, for data warehousing. Woo! And temporal is another new thing that's coming along in 16. So this is the ability to say, I want to do time-based queries on my data. So you can say, I want to look at my personnel list as of June last year, see who was employed, who was not there. And you can do that, and we've got more demos on that on Friday. But great new feature, not difficult to set up, does need some more disk space, but it's all built in out of the box. Spatial came along in 2008, so anyone who's still back in 2005, there wasn't really a good answer for doing spatial back in those days. And interaction with other systems, so there's not a lot more heterogeneousness in the data lake that you're working with these days. So we're bringing in more K capabilities out of the box to work with different data stores. So FileStream's been around for a while. So Polybase is the whole idea of being able to work with Hadoop data stores. So actually doing a select star from table name where that data is actually in Hadoop rather than directly in your SQL Server tables. And that gives you the ability to then join. So you can do a select statement that joins a Hadoop piece of data with a SQL table, just straight out of the box. So quite powerful stuff. And JSON support, so being able to format your SQL data, pump it out directly in JSON format. So very similar to the XML stuff that's been around for quite a while. But the whole idea of out of the box, being able to work and interop with other types of data stores. Dynamic Quorum is a nice little one. It's not strictly a SQL feature, but Windows 2012 R2 introduced this. So prior to this, managing quorum and votes for clusters where you had SQL on it for high availability was a little bit of a black art, and we had all sorts of weird and wonderful rules. And if you didn't follow the rules, then potentially your cluster would just give up the ghost and stop until you got it right. So Dynamic Quorum says, let's put the intelligence actually into the clustering software so that it knows all the rules and it sorts things out for you rather than just having a hissy fit and stopping. So another great thing for making it easier for you. And lots of different little tweaks in the programming area. For anyone who's back in 2005 and having to work with date time when you really just want a date, this was a great leap forward in 2008 to be able to actually just store the date in a date data type. And especially if you ever had to index a date type and you go, why have I got so many unique values in my index? This, again, big leap forward. So that's functionality. So maintenance and operations. So what have we changed to make it easier for the DBA? Because we've been talking about things that are better for the business. So Activity Monitor, which surprisingly was a 2008 feature. I think almost anyone who's working with 2005 will have just grabbed the later version of Management Studio and be managing with that, so you get that anyway, but we'll call it out. So instrumentation. So we've got the dynamic management views and the perfmon counters. So every release has been increasing the number of DMVs and counters that you get to work with, just to give you more and more visibility of what's going on under the hood. So when you get a problem or you want to do tuning, you've got more visibility of what's going on, especially with things like Always On, where you can measure to your heart's content as to what's going on and whether you've got a bottleneck. Extended events, which will eventually replace Profiler. So a new lightweight ability to do trace of what's going on in your system. Deadlock reporting, another great thing that came in. So being able to spit out meaningful information about your deadlocks and reduce the number of those, so improve the reliability of your application. This great feature that, if we'd changed it a wee bit, would have said Roman Legion, but never mind. So online index rebuilds we've been able to do for a long time, but they still have, for very busy systems, a real issue where there is a point in time where they need to get in, stop the application activity, get in, do their work, and get out again. And for really busy systems, you can get lots of blocking going on where your application will have noticeable hangs. So this was a new feature that they built in, which essentially said that we'll make index rebuilds a second-class citizen. So rather than having a big stop-go flag, standing in the middle of the road, stopping all the traffic, they can now stand at the side of the road, wait for a couple of hours for a gap in the traffic both ways, and actually do a quick dash across the road without interrupting any of the normal flow of your operations. And that included, for anyone who's using partitioning, the whole business about being able to rebuild a single partition. And Query Store, we talked about on Friday as well. So this is this whole business about being able to store information about how SQL has managed your queries. And when your system starts going slow, you can go back to that and go, well, what did the query plans look like yesterday? So you've actually got a bit of a time machine for that. Really good new feature. So And it wouldn't be a presentation if we didn't talk a little bit about the cloud. So hybrid stuff we've built in. So this is not about moving your lock, stock and barrel to the cloud, but what can you do to interoperate with cloud features. So we brought in the ability for you to put your data files up on Azure if you want to. You don't have to, but it's available as an option. We also talk on Friday about StretchDB, which is a new SQL 16 feature, which is sort of a hybrid and lets you put data on the cloud and also put your compute on the cloud for part of your database. You can backup straight to the Azure as well. So it gives you instant offsite backup. And for people using Always On, you can put one leg of your Always On replicas into Azure as well. So again, an option to say, well, if we don't want to stand up another data center, we can now stand up a replica in Azure and potentially use that as our DR. So there's nothing compulsory there, but it gives you options to play with where you're looking at how can we either expand our system, make it more highly available, all those things. So that's some of the new features and things that you can say, hey, we can make use of this, we can make our operation better, we can take some of the custom code out and reduce costs that way. What can we do to actually migrate? So, first and obvious thing is actually reading the documentation. So, Books Online has sections for every release that we have on what are the new features, what are the deprecated features, what are the breaking changes, so things that if you've got them in your code, things will stop working, and discontinued features. So great resource, lots of information in there. We've got the best practice advisor. So again, sort of slightly underutilized tool, but it's a great idea if you're looking at upgrades to actually do BPA on your existing system. So it highlights things that aren't there as a recommended practice. So you know when you're moving to your new system, either it may be a risk that will make things stop working, or you can address them in the design of your new system. And then once you've actually gone to your new system, running BPA again. So you've got a check that you've actually got it the way you want it to be. There may be things that are still flagged up and you've made a conscious choice that you want them that way, but at least you've made the choice rather than it just being a default. Upgrade Advisor. So again, this has been around for a long time and every single version has had a different Upgrade Advisor. They've taken a slightly different tack with SQL 16 that A, they've changed the look and feel of it. So that's the screenshot from a little while ago. Apparently there's an even newer version just been released. So it looks a bit like the Azure portal. But they've also changed it so that it looks at your source database and then says, well, here's where you are on the journey, and if you went up to SQL 12, these are the things that would be a problem. If you went up to SQL 14, these are some of the other things that would then become a problem as well. So it gives you a whole journey through the life cycle rather than saying, we're just going to look at this particular step. Ivan. Okay. It is still CTP, so put feedback in. Cool. And the other thing that they're doing is scenario-based. So the first scenario that they've put in there is stretch database. So that's an advisor that you can run on your existing databases and say, can I use this feature? Will it be useful for my existing environment? So they're planning on putting more scenario-based advisors in there as well. It's just what happens when I upgrade. And alongside that is the upgrade assistant. So advisor just looks at your static data inside your database. So assistant is the tool that you can pump dynamic workload into. So you can record your workload and pump things in so that it can catch things like dynamic SQL. If you've got an application that's sending in SQL from the front end, all of those things that DBAs hate because you can't actually reach out and touch the stuff statically. So it will help with catching those. And we've got technical white papers. So we've included a link at the end of the session here. And there's about a 450-page white paper for SQL 12 that steps through in a really nicely structured way about if you're doing an upgrade of these components, all of the things that you should think about. So lots and lots of detail in there. So those are some of the tools that have got blockers. So why are people still down in the dark ages of SQL 2000? So breaking changes, discontinue changes, they're all documented. So if you read through the documentation, you'll find there's actually not that many of these. We have a whole bunch of deprecated features, and there seems to be a very, very long time scale before things move from deprecated to discontinued. So the classic example is we deprecated the text data type in 2008. So if you look on the 2016 documentation, it's still in the deprecated list. So that's the, it works, but try to avoid using it for new stuff. So there's not a huge number of these, and the upgrade advisor and assistant will help flag any of those out. And if you're really looking for deprecated stuff, there's also a perfmon counter that helps pull out how many of those you're using. Just gives you a number of calls per second for those. Effort, it takes time. You've actually got to commit someone to saying, yep, we should put in work to do that. So hopefully this session helps you with what are the benefits that we get from upgrading, not just we have to do it and it's seen as a sunk cost. And the elephant in the room, I did think of using the Hortonworks elephant, but I thought I'd get told off for inappropriate use of a imagery. Application support matrix. So you've got vendors who have the little chart that says we only support SQL 2000 for our version X of our application. So there is no technical fix for this one. This is really a communication thing. So knowing who your vendor is, knowing who to talk to in there, and talking to them early, and actually saying, hey, we've got these great new features in SQL 14, and we want to use them because it'll do these things for our company. And then hopefully, the more people that talk to the vendor early, the more reason that they will have to put the effort into actually doing the testing, because a lot of time these things will actually work. It's just a supportability question. So no technical fix, but just talking to your vendor and trying to get them on board with going forward. And if you've got an opportunity, being an early adopter and helping them test, if you've got the opportunity to do that. So that's some of the blockers. So how do you actually do this? So again, not down at a technical, how do I run setup? So it is a project. So you need to do all the usual things that you would do for a project. Go through, do a plan, design, have your test cases, and then execute the project. And for people who are project managers, you'll know that Project 16 doesn't give you a project plan, it gives you a schedule. So one of the key things that you need to work out when you're doing your design is, do you do in place or side by side? So in place, just go and keep the existing machine, run setup, and magically you've got a new version. And side by side is setting up a new environment, either a new instance on your existing machines or completely new machine, and migrate your data across. So what I'd suggest in these sort of upgrades where you're coming from quite old versions, you would normally be looking at some form of side-by-side migration. It means that you can get your version of Windows up at the same time. If you're going to be running your tests on your application, why not get Windows up as well and cover it with the same test suite as well? If you've got things that you know are suboptimal in terms of how you've laid things out, how you've designed things, you can take care of that, move to a standardized layout while you're building your side-by-side environment. And then you can run through dry run tests without having to impact your production environment. And as far as your outage windows go, you can really compress that outage window down. If you're doing in place, then you're really starting your upgrade, and you've got quite a long period of time where you've got to commit to having an outage, and you've got to know that by the end of that you've got a working system again, which can be non-trivial, especially if you decide halfway through that you've got to back out, because backing out from an in-place is not really the most pleasant thing in the world. So side-by-side gives you lots of advantages through that, and especially lets you move to a standardised, optimised design. So talked a wee bit about standardisation. Decoupling is just the idea of, while you're doing this, if you've got hard coding that's still there, where you've got an application pointing directly to server names and all those sorts of things, thinking about using things like DNS aliases so that your applications and all your various connection strings are actually pointing to some form of alias layer to make it easier in future when you do your next set of migrations and upgrades, to be able to just change that in that one alias layer rather than having to go through and find all the places in your code where that stuff is scattered. So risk mitigation. So one of the things that they're doing in the newer versions of SQL is trying to say people have had this perception that when you do the upgrade, it's a jump off the cliff, and I don't know how it's actually going to work once I've done my upgrade, and mainly in terms of performance. So what they've started looking at is how can they give you guys control over that and put switches in so that you can say, I'd like the old way back, please. So SQL 14, the cardinality estimator was rewritten. So that had a big impact on the way that query plans would turn out. So they, as part of that, kept all the old code for the cardinality estimator as well and gave you control through compatibility level and through various trace flags to say, I want the new, I want the old. And you're able to switch back if you needed to. Or if you wanted to play safe, stay on the old compatibility level, and then after a while, run a test and ramp up to the new one and try the cardinality estimator. Obviously, we'd like you to use the new one because they wrote it with the intention of it being faster, better, stronger than the old code. So in most cases, it should work better for you. And 16, they've said what they want to try and do is really honour compatibility levels so that any place where they're changing the code that would have an impact on the way that query plans are generated, if you set the compatibility level down, they'll honour that and use the old code path rather than forcing the new one on you. And so one of the big benefits there is that we've got Query Store, so you can do your upgrade, keep compatibility level down, run Query Store to gather information about how all your queries are working, then up your compatibility level. You can then keep using Query Store and use that as a before and after. So Query Store is different in that it's actually a persistent data store. You don't lose it on restart. So you're able to go back in time and compare between those two compatibility levels and get a really good feel. And then use that as a way of saying, right, we know that we have some control over how this thing is actually going to behave. We've got instrumentation that can detail down for us after we've done the upgrade what's going on. So really trying to mitigate the risk that people perceive around if we upgrade, it's all going to go horribly wrong and no one's going to be able to use it. And just a point that a lot of time when we're talking to people, they ask, well, just how long can we go before we roll back? Just in, not a technical thing, but a project planning thing, you do have to get to a point where you can say, hand on heart, yep, we're going to commit. And this really comes back down to talking to the business about how do you build robust enough test cases to satisfy the business that this thing is actually going to work as a business application, so that by Monday morning, you can say, yes, we're committed to this. Anything that going forward is actually fix the problem in place. There's no point getting to Wednesday and saying, really, we didn't like that so much, because you really get yourself in a world of hurt by trying to satisfy that need. So that comes down to your planning and saying, what test cases do we need to satisfy that and be able to actually commit to that? So that's it. So we've really talked about benefits. So a lot of benefits in security, performance area, functionality, tools and cloud, and being able to hybridize. And a lot of that being able to use out-of-the-box functionality rather than workarounds or custom code that you've had to do in the past, which either wouldn't perform as well or would put a significant overhead on your operation, both from a support point of view and potentially actually taking more machine grunt to actually do the same job. Blockers, talked about breaking changes. The app matrix, so again, that's just talk to your vendors, engage them early, keep talking to them, because you never know. They might actually put some effort in. Tools, so the best practice advisors, the upgrade advisors and assistants, books online. It always helps to read the documentation. I know we have the RTFM saying from a long time ago. And the white papers, which have got lots of detail in, but really well structured, so it's not like reading War and Peace. And it is a project. You do need to plan it. The best way to fail for an upgrade is just to wing it, assume that the DBA can go on Saturday morning and have a go at upgrading it, and then everything goes horribly wrong. Not quite, but yeah. But it is planning involved. You've got multiple parties involved and involving the business in terms of being able to satisfy them and having no surprises when the upgrade actually happens. So that's it. So some related sessions that we've got. There's a really cool one that was number 3 down there, 30 Habits of Bad Server Admins, which really relates to this one, because you may have things that admins are doing because the way that you've structured your servers is actually not conducive to the things that need to be done on an ongoing operational maintenance basis. So one of the things that you can do while you're thinking about planning your upgrade and doing the design is going back to your ops folks and saying, well, what are the pain points from an operations point of view? And if there's things that they're doing that are really bad from a ongoing basis, then you can start to build fixes for those into your design. And so we're around a wee bit later during the week. I'm actually booked down at the Microsoft stand straight after this, so we'll be around. So that's about it. So questions, people? With Windows 7, ooh, I've no idea. Because you haven't got another Windows machine to work on?
If you do it in a VM, it doesn't work.
So the easiest way to play with CTP is there's an Azure Gallery image for SQL 16 CTP 2. I haven't looked lately to see whether it's been updated to anything past CTP 2.0. But that's the easiest and quickest way to get it. And you can set yourself up with a 30-day trial account of Azure. And if you think about it, it's all tied to an email account, and it's not really hard to set up a new email account. So that's the quick and dirty way of setting up, playing with it. I've no idea whether we're supporting SQL 16 on 7 at all or not. It's really aimed at sort of some of the later versions of Windows that we have. And we could ask, say there's a free upgrade. Anyone else? Yep. Compression will help with sort of run length encoding stuff. So it's very good where you have got identical values row after row. So row and page have got different scenarios, and there are various techniques out there for you to be able to run through and predict the impact of compression on those tables. So you've got some tools there that can help you out with that. If you've got things that you need mainly from a read workload point of view, then you could start looking at column store, where that will look at your column values and actually compress those. So that's a column by column compression technique as well. So it might, is the weaselly answer. Cool. And I'm supposed to throw swag at people as well. So, SQL, Windows 7, I think, gets a coffee cup. Anyone else? Anyone actually thinking of upgrading from SQL 2005 right now? Yay! Anyone not? You're stuck on some horrible legacy app? Yes, let's keep six versions of SQL Server. Okay, I've got to go through the compulsory slides. So if you're interested in us talking to you some more about this, there is an email address you can use, or you can go down to the hub. That's the resources, includes a link through to the white paper, so it's the 2012 one, and all this gets published on Channel 9, so you can go and grab the stuff from there. Do some eval, and they do give out prizes, and that's us. So thank you, people.